You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the only weapon we use in Mario Kart is the banana peel. And we only throw it at Donkey Kong. If you enjoy your trip in here into the midside today, please tell a friend. Referrals are our number one source of tourism. Also, check out our website. You can see all the archives on there, themidside.com/podcast, or pick up a shirt, themidside.com/store. That's where you can get our False Dichotomy Bro shirts or our Hail Snydra shirts. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisneski, and also joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Well, hello there. Good to be back on this show yet again. I think this is the most times I've ever appeared on a podcast in history. So congratulations, everyone. You're the real winners here.
Wait, is that even up for debate? Like, is there some other, like, secret show you're doing somewhere where there's possible you've done more episodes?
That would be the joke.
Oh, okay. Oh, I thought I was missing something. I don't know. I have this secret fear in the back of my head that, like, everyone is actually living different lives that I don't know about that they just keep me isolated from. So,
No, Justin. I would never keep you isolated if I was secretly double-timing this show. Is that the phrase? With another podcast. If I was cheating on you with another podcast, I would let you know. Okay? No need to worry there.
I mean,
all the best to Elliot, by the way, and our Midsider friends in Florida, who are currently at this very moment, as we record, going through a fucking hurricane, much like our friends in Houston did.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you are a Midsider, probably prepare for a natural disaster, because from what I've learned from the internet this week, weather is biased based upon politics.
That's right.
Hurricanes punish.
Jennifer Lawrence, who said that these hurricanes were because of Trump, like that Mother Nature was rebelling against Donald Trump. I think it was her.
She might have said that.
It's just good science. It's just good science.
That science, and then the science that these hurricanes prove global warming.
Yes, that's right. Remember that weather has no connection to global warming unless it fits our political agenda, and then it is completely connected to global warming.
Speaking of science and confirmation bias and calling people out on confirmation bias, also joining us this trip from the hills of white privilege, James Elias.
Well, I appreciate that introduction. I am here to call everyone out on their confirmation bias, and hopefully we can continue to do that today in the warm embrace of the midside.
Would you say, though, that you're biased against confirmation bias?
I would absolutely say that. And because, you know, if you think about it, no one's really free of bias. Everyone has their own biases. We're all imperfect humans. And that means we can never judge one another for anything the other says. And there is no such thing as truth. And we should give up now.
All right. That got way too fucking deep for me.
I hope you enjoyed your journey into the midside.
Yeah. So you look just out there, remember to tell a friend, and when things get tough, back up and look at the farce.
I'm glad you know the outro. I really just want to watch football, so can you just get to your sucking up right now?
Sucking up on what?
Didn't you mean...
Weren't you going to give a thing?
Yeah, a shout out. Did you meet Rucka Rucka Ali?
Oh, that's right. Oh, okay. I totally forgot about that. Yeah. I
meant suck up ever.
So yeah, I had ramen with the infamous Rucka Rucka Ali, the maker of many funny songs on the internet, including probably the midside's favorite, which is Punch a Nazi. Just this, or actually he only did the vocals for that. I believe it was Chris Reagan who wrote it, but he did the vocals for that. He has all these songs about Obama and Trump that I play over and over again at my apartment, much to the chagrin of Mackenzie. But yeah, met him for ramen. Really great guy. He was telling me about his work that he's actually posting. Well, for you guys, it'll be last Sunday. He's posted this video that's 2 years in the making for him, so that'll be exciting. And I told him about the Midside. So if Rucka Rucka, if you're listening, welcome to the Midside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Punch a Nazi is how I heard about it, him. That is a parody of Paparazzi by Lady Gaga for all the Midsiders out there who haven't seen it.
No.
And it's making fun of this whole Antifa idea that it's okay in our society if you just disagree with someone to just punch them.
Funny. You know, I yeah. had watched that whole song, enjoyed it, never knew it was a parody.
Yeah.
That's how disconnected I am from modern music.
That's okay. I can tell you stories. I ended up at an Asian club, don't even ask how. And like 75% of the songs they didn't play I knew, and the 25% I did know were from the 90s. So I was like, yeah, I am that guy.
Yeah, I hate to pull the politically correct card here, but I believe it's Asian crub. So let's just be, you know, sensitive to these issues.
Yeah, sorry. I think we have to worry about being sensitive about a lot of issues today because we got a lot of stuff in the news. Let's get to that. It's time for the news with Daniel C. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Seattle Seahawks defensive end Michael Bennett was detained and may file a federal civil rights lawsuit against the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department for allegedly using excessive force on him as they investigated an incident at a casino last month. In a statement posted to Twitter on Wednesday, Bennett described the chaotic situation he was involved in on the way back to his hotel. He was, of course, coming back from the Floyd Mayweather-Conor McGregor fight when several people were running away from what they thought were gunshots, and the police yelled at Bennett to get on the ground, and they detained him while he was on the ground. And according to Bennett, one of the police officers pointed a gun at his head and said he would blow my fucking head off. He also said the officer jammed a knee into his back and made it difficult for him to breathe. Bennett went on to say that he felt helpless, and he's trying to point out that this happens all the time to people who aren't high-profile celebrities, so on and so forth. The NFL, his teammates, the coach, who's Pete Carroll, have all come out on Bennett's behalf and said he's a great guy. Now Bennett's considering suing. Justin, when did you hear about this? I'm curious how this came to your knowledge, because I had an interesting way of hearing about it, so I'm curious.
Well, I am a fucking nerd, and I follow at Pro Football Talk on Twitter. And basically, I only go to certain feeds now. I don't, like, go to my timeline anymore because Twitter is trash. And I just went to them, and on their feed, on their timeline, it said this story, and that's how I discovered it. And I wouldn't have – this wouldn't have been a story for me otherwise. It's also – the article we have here is posted on NFL.com, so I probably would have seen it that way.
Yeah. No, I say mine's interesting only because – when I saw it in Twitter, it was someone commenting about how they actually appreciated Michael Bennett's not resisting arrest. And I thought that was an interesting take on this whole situation where, you know, Adam Carolla, how long did it take us to mention him in this episode, often does the thing where he says, you know, if you are detained by police, like, we should not be telling people resist, resist, resist. We should be telling people comply, 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 because that's the only way you're going to save your life. And so the fact that
he
did comply was an interesting sort of like, look, it actually does work, or at least it has a better chance of working than telling the police officer to go fuck himself, you dirty pig. Like, one of those has a higher likelihood of you getting shot in the back of the head. So
yeah, this happened. I don't know if you saw Midsider Morgan made a post about a similar situation where there was a nurse. And the cop came in demanding, like, a blood sample or something from one of her patients.
Yeah.
And she read him a letter about how she didn't have to give it, like, legally.
Yeah.
And then the cop arrested her for it. And she just starts hooting and hollering about how she didn't do anything and this is unfair and blah, blah, blah. And I replied with exactly what you just said. Like, yeah, the cop is in the wrong in this situation, but all you're doing is giving a stupid person with a weapon an excuse to hurt you if you're acting like this. Yeah. Like, why act like this? Like, just say you're innocent. Just say, I didn't do anything. I'm innocent. But why do you have to yell about it? And then the most insane thing to me was some random person replied to me and was telling me that I was victim blaming.
Victim blaming. Yes. I love that. Victim blaming. No, I'm telling you how you act in a situation where someone has a gun and they are legally allowed to use it against you. That's what I'm telling you to do. Clearly, she's not at fault. Clearly, Michael Bennett is not at fault. But the point is, in a situation where you are dealing with someone who has the legal use of force, you need to comply and then get your retribution where you have the power, which is in the court system. This doesn't just come from me. This comes from attorneys across the country who are telling their clients this, including high-profile attorneys like Mark Garagus, who is, again, an Adam Carolla person. But his whole point is, in the streets, the police have power. In the courtroom, you have power.
Right,
so
100%.
Make it to the courtroom.
And don't forget that we've covered to make it to the courtroom. Can we make a t-shirt for that? No, that would not sell at all. But no, and I want to reiterate something or reinforce something we've talked about on the show before. They intentionally hire people with low IQs to be cops.
Yes.
So you're sitting here and you're complaining that cops have poor judgment when they know that. They've intentionally hired people with poor judgment. So you need to know that the people you're dealing with have poor judgment and you need to act accordingly.
Yes, we covered that story a while ago, right? Where there was a police department who denied a guy's application because his IQ was too high.
Yeah, that might have even been like season 3 or some shit. I don't even remember.
Yeah.
That feels like it was a long time ago. That feels like it was a different lifetime. But I actually want to be stronger on the Michael Bennett thing because of this. I really do. I get that he didn't resist. I get that. But what I want to know is what the cop really did that was wrong here. First of all, it's a he said with the whole, I'm going to blow your fucking head off. Because there's a video on TMZ Sports of this where the cop is doing no such thing. He's just arresting him. And there's no gun pointed at him. And it's one cop on him. So, I mean, maybe it happened beforehand. I don't know. But even if he did say that, like, why are you suing the police, right? This is social justice grandstanding. It really is.
Yeah. And it's like... assuming he did, it's kind of funny because Bennett at least could have exaggerated. He at least could have lied because this description of his arrest just sounds like the appropriate thing you do when arresting someone who's suspected of an active shooter situation. You point a gun at them, then you use your body to make sure they can't resist as you cuff them. And then you yell things to indicate your aggression so that they don't aggress against you. Like, it's just, that sounds like, it's not pleasant. It's sucky that he had to go through all of this. I've actually been detained by the police myself. And for not doing anything wrong, and it turned out fine, but it was very unpleasant to deal with them, and they didn't do anything this rough, of course, but it was still extremely unpleasant because you're at the mercy of another human being. But that's the way we have to do things. And you know what, so did Bennett, but I cooperated, and
but he ended didn't up cooperate fine. As much, because to add to your context, these are also cops who are used to dealing with drunk buffoons on the Las Vegas Strip. I mean, if you've ever been to Las Vegas and you watch the video, it's very clearly right on the Strip, right outside a casino. So they are used to having to be this aggressive to deal with people in Las Vegas. And he wasn't that compliant. I mean, why do you need to yell over and over again, I'm innocent? Like, why are you putting on a show? It's so second-handed.
Well, the thing I will say about this, regardless of, whether or not he complied or not, I think he did enough that he should be applauded. What's really good, James? Just curious. Eating soup. I like the soup commentary though. The added soup commentary track to the midside. That's really really what the
except
sorry guys, I muted my mic to eat some food and then I told McKenzie
show
that it was really fucking good.
Goddamn respect to Michael Bennett. He is a Seattle
you guys
Seahawk.
Can hear me.
For fuck's sake.
Best podcast ever. Sorry, guys. Shit.
Derailed. Okay, so.
Seriously, I'm going to delete all of this. So
no,
can you just, like,
this is
not
awesome.
Eat? We can't, they can't
pod.
Hear him. His
no, they heard the latter
is...
half. I did turn my mic on later in the episode.
Okay. Then I'm just going to be a fucking, I'm going to be Adam Carolla. Can you just not fucking eat during the podcast? Like, it's an hour and a fucking half. Just don't fucking eat.
I'm hungry.
Diabetic?
Yeah,
your blood sugar
fucking...
going to drop dangerously low?
Did you just fly in from Ethiopia and they're just, like, giving you your first food in, like, years? Like,
are you
kind
coming
of,
off
it's
of 24-hour
fasting? It's been
fasting?
16 hours since I ate.
Oh, okay. Pretty close.
Well, what the fuck are you doing going on a starvation diet? Dude, you're in America. Goddamn, go to In-N-Out.
It's just in, it's in perseverance or solidarity or whatever.
That's right. I love everything about this. Okay. So, what I was
so
going
Michael,
to say
so Bennett.
And you're eating goddamn soup, too.
Before
soup.
The soup.
No, I'm eating an omelet, is okay. What it is. In case you wanted to know.
Was that, I want to applaud Bennett for the compliance thing. I think that's good overall, regardless of how he did it. I think it's good overall. But here's the thing that gets shoved into this always, which is that it's a race issue, right? Everything is a race issue, no matter what, no matter the context. Race, 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 race. Continue beating that drum until it's broken. Why is it a race issue? The police responded to an active shooter situation. They were given a description of the shooter that happened to be close to what Michael Bennett looked like, and they detained someone who looked like that. What is the alternative? What exactly do people want in these situations? The police, when they get an active shooter call, to go, "Bup, fuck it, we can't detain anyone because, God, we might be called racists." Isn't that horrible? What do you actually want them to do?
It's narcissistic. Daniel, that's part of what I'm saying about this whole showmanship second-handed of yelling, "I'm innocent, I'm innocent." They're not thinking of the broader context that you just said, that other people's lives could be in danger. All they're thinking of is, "I didn't do anything wrong. How dare you punish me because I don't deserve this?" And then they're trying to come up with a rationalization for why it's happening, and they come up with the race thing. It's narcissism, 100%.
Yeah. It's it blows my mind every single time. I just not here. News alert: not everything is a race issue.
What pisses me off the most is because Big Balls Pete Carroll. That's what we called him at USC. Big Balls Pete. In case you were wondering, Big Balls Pete in his statement. He just fucking completely assumes that the cops were in the wrong. He just says this is indicative of a lot of racial inequality incidents that have occurred recently. It's just like, what the fuck you? We haven't seen all the facts of the case. Maybe they did arrest the wrong guy. And, you know, maybe they did make some sort of mistake based on race they should have. Like assuming the most. I mean, it's probably not. But, like, assuming your point, Pete Carroll, like, why don't you wait until the evidence comes in? And the fact that they're not willing to do that shows that, yeah, this is all just, how'd you put it, Justin? It's grandstanding. It's just grandstanding. We're going to make everything about race.
Yeah. I have a really just hyper-practical point that just pisses me off all the time, which is, like, the same thing at, like, the airports where we're detaining 88-year-old grandmothers in wheelchairs and putting them through extra security, where it's like, if you get a description of an active shooter as a 6'7" black man wearing a plaid shirt, and you see a 6'7" black man wearing a plaid shirt running from the scene, why are you not allowed to make a reasonable assumption that this could be the person involved? Are you supposed to then profile literally anyone running from the scene, including a 9-year-old Asian girl? Like, oh, get her, she could, I can't assume. Can't assume someone's race. Can't assume the description.
What if they're
right.
Transgender? Or what if they're trans race?
That's right.
What
if they're racial
dolezal? Turned into a racial, into a Chinese girl while running away?
To be fair, if an Asian was going to be an active shooter, I would expect it to be a 9-year-old Asian girl because she would be overachieving. So.
That's right. I'm going to be the youngest.
Whereas most
shooter.
People shoot 10 people, she shot 20. That's not even funny.
That's
sorry.
No, that's not funny at all. And one thing I want to add before we move on here is I could go on a very long Pete Carroll rant right now, but I won't because that is more appropriate for our new show, Belichick Your Premises, which is a football podcast which will come out every Tuesday on the Welcome to the Midside feed and on Welcome to the Midside, or on themidside.com. I'm sorry, themidside.com.
I'd like to add.
Oh, I was going to transition into my glorious.
I was going to add one more thing on this.
Yes.
If you read the story carefully, it says they part of the reason they actually arrested him is because he was apparently crouching behind a slot machine, which is behavior indicative of being a shooter. You know, like if you're a shooter, you might be taking cover and shooting. And so that's what made them think maybe it was him. And I just find that kind of funny because, like, what was he? I guess he was crouching in order to, you know, avoid bullets. But the guy, it's just every time we look in the news, we see this guy crouching for one reason or another. I just thought that was kind of funny.
Croucher.
Michael Bay crouching?
Crouching, hidden shooter.
Crouching. Yeah. Well, not crouching, but kneeling. We've heard him kneeling before for the flag, right? So
I think you're confusing him with Colin Kaepernick, you racist.
Well, Kaepernick did it too, but didn't the entire Seahawks team do it?
Bennett's a kneeler as well. Bennett's a kneeler as well.
Yeah, he's one of them kneelers.
That sounds way too close to the N-word.
Moving on. That sounds way too close to the N-word. So what you're saying doesn't
No one was thinking it until you said it, Justin. Thank you.
No,
for
everyone was thinking it, James.
Everyone was
thinking
it.
Yeah, everyone was thinking it.
The show has reached a new low. So what you're saying, Justin, is that you're going to pass on the Pete Carroll talk from the short yardage? Okay, so lawyer.
Even I got that.
Laura Dunn, a prominent advocate for sexual assault victims, believes that people accused of rape on college campuses should not have a presumption of innocence. She said, in a quote, "A presumption of innocence advantages the accused only, and Title IX requires equity." This came from an email to Insider Higher Ed magazine. Quote, "No presumption should be made either way, and schools should engage in an inquisitorial process to determine the truth rather than artificially favor the accused going into it." An inquisitorial process. Yes, no one expects the campus inquisition. So, Justin, what do you think? Should we abolish the presumption of innocence when it comes to rape victims on college campuses?
Isn't the presumption of innocence based on reality? And what I mean by that is, if you don't have the presumption of innocence, it favors the accuser. Except, if you accuse someone, you can accuse without evidence, but you can't defend yourself by just presenting no evidence. You can't just say, I'm innocent. You then have to present evidence. Whereas accusers, they can just come out of nowhere and be like, you raped me. So we have they always say it with that sort of vitriol too.
Pictured
you raped me.
A woman jumping out from behind a bush. You're like, hey, you raped me. Yeah.
That's exactly what I was picturing. You read my mind. Mm-hmm. But no, we have to have that in there because reality dictates accusations have to be proven with evidence.
Yeah, that's a thing of logic, right? That's a rule of logic. The burden is on the positive assertion.
Right.
Because, and like to sort of draw out what Justin implied there, like if the burden of proof is on you to show that you're innocent, then it's actually impossible to prove your innocence because the accuser can now say oh, well, I wasn't even in the room with you. Here's a videotape or here's someone who can testify that I was at the movies with them at the time. Like, well, how do we know they're not lying? Okay. And then you show some sort of proof they're not lying. Like, okay, well, how do we know that proof they're not lying wasn't doctored? You know, like they can, as soon as you're allowed to make arbitrary claims on the side of the accuser, it now becomes impossible to defend yourself. So
now
she's completely misrepresenting this issue because it's not a matter of being even-handed. It's a matter of just the epistemological rule that he who asserts the positive has the burden of proof.
Do you guys remember that meme of the woman? I think it was from Wife Swap or something where it was like, she's not a Christian. Do you remember that meme?
What?
No.
Oh, well, that was a meme, and I'm now picturing her yelling at any sort of evidence. Photoshopped! It's like, here's my ticket from going to the movie, or here's my the video of me at the movies, and she just yells Photoshopped at it. I'm picturing that. But there's actually a deeper thing going on here than what you're talking about, James. Is epistemologically, it's moving away from reality, and it's moving completely towards collectivism. The reason we're assuming someone is guilty and we're getting rid of innocent until proven guilty is they're assuming rape culture, which is ultimately assuming the idea that all men are rapists or all men are – their sexuality is dangerous. It's a weapon towards women.
It's toxic.
That's what that is talking about. Yeah, toxic. Right. There we go. It's the toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess when you're judging things, I mean, this is just the reverse end of what we saw in the first story, whereas first we're assuming innocence based on, or we're assuming mistreatment based on race, now we're assuming guilt because of sex.
Yes.
Right. Basically. So everything now is not based upon who you are as an individual, which is what innocent until proven guilty is based upon. It's the idea that every individual has the right to defend him or herself. Or Z self, I guess, I don't know, in a court of law. They're, you need evidence to prove that they did something. You can't just go around and say, Z did it, Z did it. Now,
<That's your> French.
Now, everything is just collectivist. Based upon whatever group you are, you either did or didn't do it. And there's nothing you can do to defend yourself against it. You just have to accept, based upon whatever group you're part of, that that's your fate.
Yes, the new caste system in America.
So Daniel or Justin, because why is it that the left wants the reintroduction of tribalist collectivism? That's at least slipping my mind right now. It doesn't seem to obviously integrate with everything else they're doing.
Well, to me, and Daniel, you can tell me if you disagree or not. To me, it's as simple as divide and conquer. So you divide all these people into groups. And then you tell them all, we have this group's back, and you're the victim, and we're going to help you, and that's how you get them.
Yeah, it's in a similar manner. I think it has to do with how they think of a power structure, and this comes from Justin and I's favorite rhetoric professor, Victor Vitanza, who had this concept of the constantly circulating, revolving door of the power structure, which is you create a bunch of groups, and then when one group gets into power, basically, you use all the other groups to get them out of power and put another group in power so you can use all the groups to get that group out of power. And thus, it's a constant shift of who's in power, and you get to control all these other groups while making one group the out-group.
Right, and on a deeper level, everything you just said is correct. I agree with that 100%. And on a deeper level, you have to look at what it does to the individual psychology. Right here in the Midside, what we always talk about is how does this affect you as an individual and hurt your chances of living as an individual in the world. Well, this is a prime example of it. If you're convinced that you're a member of a group and the group determines what happens to you, well, that destroys your sense of efficacy, which destroys your self-esteem. I mean, ultimately, what Michael Bennett has internalized in his arrest and his going after the police department is that they didn't treat him as Michael Bennett. They treated him as a black man. So he didn't believe that he would ever be found innocent in a court of law, ultimately, because he's black. That's what he thought. Then that was thinking collectivistly. And that's where I said that's where it weirdly ends up at a narcissism, too. Oh, well, I want to be left alone because I didn't do anything, blah, blah, blah. So it's you walk this fine line. And it's the same thing with this whole toxic masculinity thing. It destroys a man's efficacy to actually approach a woman and actually have sex with a woman because he's being seen as just a man. He's not being seen as himself. And that's ultimately why you can control people in groups, because they have to huddle in the group in order to be protected and get what they need to survive. They don't believe they can go out on their own and do it, because they think if they go out on their own, they're just going to be judged for their group and not who they are individually.
The group now has a monopoly on values, and as a result, what that really means is that the leaders of these groups have monopolies on values, which is exactly kind of the was their goal to begin with.
Yeah.
This sort of reminds me of how Nazism and communism, at least within the Soviet Union, both utilized existing forms of tribalism in order to enforce their own. Like, Nazism was not a necessarily religious philosophy in any way, but they very much tore into religion and said, like, okay, yeah, that's just part of what we're talking about. And so they, even though they weren't particularly religious, they completely embraced the existing tribalist structures that already existed in order to just unify and rule people, not just divide and conquer, but unify and rule. So
yeah, all of the above. I have nothing to add to that. You're both geniuses.
Wow.
Speaking of geniuses, Snapchat turns out to be a genius thanks to Hurricane Harvey. What? Snapchat's once creepy map feature went from being really intrusive to really useful. So this is something that I know barely anything about, which is terrible because of my career choice. But Snapchat has a map feature where users can attach their location to stories. Justin, if I say anything incorrect, you as our resident Snapchat expert need to jump in and correct me. So,
okay, I'm sending you a dick pic right now.
Okay.
I'd send one dick pic per correction and have the text just over, just around the head. Can you do that with Snapchat? Is there a filter for that where it, like, ensconces the head with words?
Oh, I thought you meant with the dick. So it was like a dick head.
The head of the dick.
Yeah, okay. Oh, I see what you mean. Sorry, wildly confused. Don't know my Snapchat parlance. Okay. Snapchat Maps displays the specific location of snaps shared to the public Our Story stream. That was a horribly written sentence, but it's from this story. That means users can zoom in on any location in the world to see what photos and videos people are posting. The Snapchatters are anonymous, and users can't reply to them, but Snapchat's geolocation and timestamp feature ensures that it came from that particular location at a particular point in time. So basically, how this was used... in Houston, a quick search on the map put users right in the convention center where thousands of people are seeking shelter and volunteers are working hard at supplies, or you can hover over different neighborhoods to watch people being rescued from submerged houses by rescuers in boats. You can see users posting locations of power outages. You can watch the floodwaters rise or recede through the eyes of Snapchatters posting from particular locations over time. You can even peer into people's houses and watch as they sift through damaged furniture and mementos. Justin, what say you? Is this a good development? Interesting development? Bad development? What's going on here? I know nothing about Snapchat.
I think this is a great development because one of my major problems with social media in general is this idea that people are just posting things to virtue signal and posting things to, you know, just sort of emotionally vent. It's very emotionalism. But here they're actually showing what's going on in reality with video. Now, obviously, video can, you know, you're controlling the lens and all of that, and we can argue about that. But as far as moving towards a healthier, better use of social media, I think this is a far better use. I've been saying for years that video is a better use of social media than text because it's less mediated. And also the idea that you can go anywhere in the world, really, and see what's going on. That's a really cool feature. Like, I'm zoomed all the way out on the map right now, and I can see a Midsider. I can see his Bitmoji up over in, Sweden? I don't know my geography. Yeah, Sweden. Up over in the southern part of Sweden near Denmark, I can see his Bitmoji. And I can see one of my cousins in Canada, and then I can see my Bitmoji in California. And
I can see you too, Justin. Can you see me? Well, I'm looking at it right now.
I don't see your Bitmoji. It must not have loaded yet.
But. Yeah, I put it in ghost mode.
Oh, well, that's why I can't see it, you fucking idiot. You know what ghost mode means?
Like, I was just trying to make sure. Oh, wow. And so, yeah, like, you can see random snaps from people. Like, I just am looking at a snap in Fullerton. Yeah, so now everyone's learning how to use Snapchat. Good pod, guys. No, but this is pretty fucking cool. Like, I'm just looking at random... I kind of wish I wasn't, but I'm just looking at random snaps from random people in... Hawthorne, it looks like. No, Fullerton. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
so,
fucking
look,
wild.
There's two things, right? There's two things with this map. They have specific stories that Snapchat curates. Like, we see all the games right now. Giants, Cowboys, Jaguars, Texans, Raiders, Titans. And then, if you go to any heat spot, which they're talking about, like, in Miami, there's a huge fucking red spot because everyone is probably... Yeah, it's all hurricane shit right now. So... It's really cool that if something happens spontaneously that the news doesn't necessarily want to cover, it'll show up on this map. And you can just click on it and be like, why the fuck is it, like, all fucking red, like, right now? So it's really fucking red in London. So what the fuck? Oh, there's a carnival going on in London. I wouldn't have fucking known about that. You know what I mean?
That's so cool, yeah. Dude, yeah, I'm seeing all this stuff.
I think it's a really cool use of social media. And I also am not concerned, and maybe, Daniel, this is something you have a different opinion on, but I'm not concerned. I mean, you can go in ghost mode like James just did, but I'm not concerned having my Bitmoji there and people can see where I am. I think it's cool that if you want to know where I am, you're like, oh, you know, I wonder where Justin is. You can sign into this map and you'll know where I am. Because you have to be friends with me to get that.
I think it's cool. I mean, Fize and I use this feature privately on the phones where we have the Find Your Friend feature on the iPhone so that we know where each other is at all time, which has actually been remarkably helpful on occasion. And so I don't really have a major concern there. You know, obviously there's the Snowden stuff, you might say, like government using this information or hackers using this information. So I want to make, you know, I hope that Snapchat's cybersecurity is on point. But overall, my thinking about all this technological stuff is that the marketplace will work out the safety issues. It will work out how it functions so that people are drawn to it and not pushed away from it. And I think this is one feature that makes it pretty shockingly useful, whereas before I thought it was kind of stupid. So.
Yeah, I mean, like, all I had to do, people bitch about stuff like this, like, oh, it's so creepy, like, I just put yourself in ghost mode. I'm so sick of, I mean, you already covered that, Justin, but I'm just sick in general of us saying, like, oh, we have all these new powers, let's poo-poo it because we don't want the extra responsibility required to manage these new powers. Yeah. Like, you know, what if I'm my little kid? Okay, well, then don't let your little kid have Snapchat until you think he's ready for it. Look at the apps he's downloading. Look at it's just like anything else. Is he ready to use a gun? No, he's 10. You know, wait until he's 11. You know, no, I mean, some 10-year-olds are, I think, can be responsible with a gun, but
we cannot let these 9-year-old Asian girls have weapons because they will become shooters.
That's right. They're going to show us all up. They're going to be more accurate.
You got to wait until they're 11.
They're going to know how to evade the police. Yeah.
And if you don't think they're ready, don't let them have the fucking thing. And if you don't think you're ready, put yourself in ghost mode. Like, oh my God. Yeah. What's up with that? Why is it? I mean, it just seems like people just have it out for technology and just things getting better. It's like, I can't help but think that sometimes.
Well, again, it's the victim mentality. It's everything is a threat to you, right? It's the victim mentality with the narcissism. Everything is a threat to you. Oh, it's, well, you know, I can't have someone know where my location is because the government's going to come and get me. Shit. Like, I don't know. Like, fine, let the government know where the fuck I am. I mean, do they really want to know that right now I'm in my apartment in Anaheim and then most of the time I'm at work in Anaheim? Like, I'll fucking give you, I will dox myself on this podcast. Like, I don't give a shit.
You should still have the choice in that regard.
Oh, 100%. I'm not saying anything about choice. I'm just saying, like, stop thinking it's going to fucking hurt you. Like, most of you are insignificant fucks, okay? You're insignificant. Get over it.
Right, the government, you're saying, you're not insulting our audience, you're simply saying that most people in our audience are not going to be singled out and attacked by the government or by anyone at all.
No, I'm not just insulting our audience, I'm insulting everyone in the world. Okay, James?
Like, no one, everyone is not that important.
Correct.
I'm just here to make sure everyone understands you, Justin. I'm just saying.
I mean, he's literally insulting more than 6 billion people. Yeah.
Correct.
Especially correct. You people in, like, Sri Lanka. Fuck you.
Just don't take it personally. That's all I'm saying. None of us are that important, okay? I include me. I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror and I go, you are not that important, you insignificant fuck.
Yes.
I do that every morning, too.
Yeah, it is. I learned that from my therapist.
Do
she
that
said,
one.
Do that every
jerk
morning
it off
and you'll
the
be
mirror.
Fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what you meant, right? Yeah, okay.
Well, I mean, I gotta lube myself up with the tears. I do probably say that first.
That's right. Speaking of not taking things personally, a Greek life retreat was canceled after a banana peel was found in a tree. This is woke. Yes, a Greek life retreat at the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, was promptly canceled this weekend due to banana peel hanging from tree. Interim director of fraternity and sorority life, Alexa Lee Arndt, remarked in an email between Greek leaders, quote, to be clear, Many members of our community were hurt, frightened, and upset by what occurred. Because of the underlying reality many students of color endure on a daily basis, the conversation manifested into a larger conversation about race relations today at the University of Mississippi. Going on further to quote someone named McNeil, Michaela McNeil, president of Alpha Kappa, Alpha, said the overall tone was heavy.
Wait, AKA? Yes. Is there another name for that sorority?
I mean, we were talking about race in Mississippi and in the Greek community, so there's a lot involved. She said that her friends were all just sort of paranoid for a second after spotting the banana. Justin, which is a more frightening fruit? Banana or dragon fruit?
We have to read the next paragraph of this story. Sorry to interrupt. I know Justin always goes first, but we have to read the next paragraph
go
of
ahead,
the story
no,
before
like,
moving on.
Go ahead. I could do an hour on this, so go ahead.
After, so keeping in mind everything Daniel just said, here's the next paragraph. After word of the banana spread through the retreat, leaders decided to end the event early. Like...
Arndt explained that she felt it was imperative to provide space immediately to students affected by this incident.
So
keep in mind,
take this paragraph.
We're not talking about fucking Hurricane Harvey. We're talking about...
Or like an infectious disease. After word of the life-threatening ailment spread throughout the retreat, yes. Leaders decided to end the event early. No, banana. Banana in the fucking tree.
It's not even a banana. It's the outer husk of the banana. It's the banana peel. Like, there's not even any substance to the banana.
Oh my good God.
This is pretty funny.
I think we need a definitive ranking of frightening fruits.
I don't know. I find a banana pretty frightening when you use it for scale, personally. It's very intimidating.
That's true.
Use the banana. Be as rough as you'd like with it. You know, the Monty Python. Like, I think he did end with a banana. That was considered the worst fruit that required defense with a gun.
Right, this is a new way of saying use a banana for scale. Use a banana for scale of outrage. Were you more or less outraged than the banana peel?
On a scale from banana peel to kneeling for the flag, how outraged are you right now?
That's right. I'm so blown away. So we now assume that banana means racism. How many levels of abstraction are we just blowing through to say that any stray banana peel means racism?
It was a banana peel in a tree, to be fair.
Okay.
Well, okay, look, the kid might have been lying. The kid might have been lying, but he said he couldn't find a trash can, so he just threw it there. I'm inclined to believe him because he's a lazy college fuck. And he was just like, I'm not going to worry about disposing of this. I'm just going to throw it in nature. It's biodegradable anyway.
I just... Okay, imagine if you were a psychologist and you specialized in treating people who thought the government was listening to them through their teeth. Okay, like through the radio waves in their teeth. And every time this group came in for group therapy... You started screaming, "Everyone be quiet! Everyone be quiet!" Because they could be listening. That is what we're doing in these situations, where these kids are screaming, the government's listening through our teeth, and we're saying, yeah, turn the radio down. Like, we are fucking with their heads for the sake of, what, social justice? We are literally creating mentally damaged human beings for the sake of being politically correct. This is one
well, the
time.
Argument, the this argument the... would be that they're already traumatized and we're just re-traumatizing them or we're indulging their trauma.
But that's my point. Like, that's what these counselors are doing, is they are literally they're creating more mentally unstable people by re-indulging this quote-unquote trauma every time you do it. To use a much simpler version that Dr. Drew uses, if someone's afraid of getting into elevators, you don't ever tell them you never have to take an elevator again. You tell them, be in the you know, vicinity of an elevator for a few minutes. Then try to take an elevator for one flight. Then, you know, try to take it for five flights, whatever. Like, you reintroduce them to elevators because you don't want them to live a crippled life.
Now I'm picturing one of the counselors eating bananas in front of these kids.
Yeah, that's the first step. That's the first step of conquering their phobia. Maybe then you'll eat a banana. Then maybe you'll be allowed to play Mario Kart and stay in first for a while. Like, I didn't want to be in first in Mario Kart because then I'll end up with a banana peel as my weapon. And then, you know, I'll feel like I'm offending people of color.
No. The second thing after he eats the banana is he hands the banana peel to the person next to him in the trust circle. And they all have to hand the banana around and cry as they each handle the banana peel.
That's right. Put it in your mouth. Put the banana in your mouth. Do it.
Right. Oh, my God.
Think about
the fact that,
what was it? What were the two words? They were frightened and what by the banana peel?
They were, it's three words, Justin. It was hurt, frightened, and upset.
You're hurt by a banana peel. You're hurt by a banana peel. Okay, I have an irrational fear. Daniel, you share this fear with me.
Oh, yeah.
I am irrationally afraid of spiders,
yes.
Okay? If there's a spider near me and it's of a certain size, I can't kill it. I want to kill it. I had one in the sink the other day, and I was like, I'm going to be a man, and I'm going to overcome my fear, and I'm going to kill that spider. But you want to know the problem? I looked at the fucking spider, and I went, that shit could jump on me, and that shit could bite me, and I could die. There is a legitimate line of irrational logic, but there is logic that this ugly motherfucking thing could kill me. What the fuck is a banana peel going to do to you that you need to shut down an entire retreat?
What is the best possible argument they can make, right? That the banana peel indicates that there are people around who want to lynch them? Like, is that the actual argument?
So is the fear that we're living in the purge? Is that the fear? That life is just a purge now?
Well, the fear comes back to this collectivism that you were talking about earlier. The fear is that all white people at any moment could go insane and just want to lynch you. That's the fear.
Yeah.
Look, I get that. I've said this before. Like, I empathize with that, okay? Especially because I was in an Asian club the other night. I mean, I'm standing in an Asian club, and I'm standing next to a Hispanic woman, and I look at her. This is in downtown L.A. I got dragged to an Asian club. It's a whole story. I don't want to go into it. But I'm in the club, and there are all these Asians everywhere, right? And I'm standing near the door because I'm hypervigilant, and I know, like, if a bunch of people are going to trample out of here, I want to be closest to the door so I can, like, get the fuck out before everyone else. But I'm also standing next to this Hispanic woman, and I'm looking at her, and I go, you know, shit goes down, like, we're on the same team, right? And she's like, yep. It's just something you recognize if, like, if you're the minority in a group, you recognize that that shit could happen. But you also have to have the knowledge of the safety of the society we live in. Like, I looked around, and I go, none of these fucking people are going to want to cause problems. Like, they just don't. First of all, they're Asian, like... whatever, they don't care. They're just going to, like, outmath me or something. And second of all, like, it's just that we don't live in a society. These people just want to get drunk, take acid or whatever, and, like, grind up on each other. I'm insignificant. They're not going to kill me because I'm white. And that's where this collectivist narcissism comes in. They're at this retreat. And was it a Greek retreat? So it was, like, sorority and fraternity guys trying to fuck each other, basically?
Yeah.
That's basically what it was?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, they're going to get drunk first, but yeah.
Okay, so it's the same thing. You're really narcissistic enough to believe they care enough about your fucking tribe that they're going to give up the opportunity to get laid to kill you? You're that fucking important? They're going to get their dick sucked, and they're going to go, hold on, Mary Sue. Don't suck my dick. I got to go kill this kneeler over here.
Wow.
Justin, I don't think you understand. If you were at that Asian nightclub and they had served you a round-eye steak, how do you think you'd have felt?
Oh, I said, hey, this is a pretty good steak.
That's incredible.
Here's a point about the mental illness aspect of this. I can't help but draw the parallels between what you were talking about, Richards, Sir Richards, Daniel, what you were talking about, Daniel, and what you were talking about, you know, thinking of this as like almost a therapy situation. And of course, the catering to the illusions or potential illusions of transgender people.
Sure.
There has to be some sort of integration there. I'm always looking for, you know, ways that philosophies are consistent in deep and meaningful ways, and this appears to somehow be one of them.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know what the exact connection is, but it's basically a form of appealing to everyone's emotionalism, that you're the way you know the world is through your emotional mechanism and not through your rational mechanism.
Right, correct. Right. That's 100% what it is. It's how you feel.
What better way to advocate for emotionalism than to actually cater to and uphold the worst of our emotions, the most irrational of our emotions, as having significance and truth?
Yeah, totally. Wow, that was heavy. That was heavy, guys. That banana peel was heavy.
I don't eat bananas, so no one can accuse me of being racist. So.
Yeah, neither do I.
And on one final note before we move on here, when we're talking about irrational things about bananas, I love when, like, unattractive women are like, I won't eat a banana in public. It's like, fuck you. No one is going to think you are performing oral sex. They're not going to want to look at you.
Why?
Yes. It's only unattractive women, too. It's never a hot woman. It's like, I don't want to eat a banana in public.
I don't think I've ever looked at anyone eating a banana and thought, yeah, go down on that banana. Because it's a fucking banana. And I'm just
not going to get it. It's slightly phallic, Daniel.
I mean, that's a thing where it's like, once you start looking at the world in terms of phallic symbols, like, you can't stop. It's endless.
Except like sucker punch, that's phallic
symbol. It's so stupid. It's why Freudian interpretation of anything is fucking retarded and only exists in English departments.
But speaking of things that, you know, might be retarded and only exist in English departments and interpreting and blah, 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 let's talk about some trailers, and I want to review a movie. It's time for The Hopeful Romantic with JML. So really quickly this week, I want to review a movie that came out a while ago. I'm not 100% sure when it came out because I didn't do my research and look it up on IMDb. But I watched the movie, and that's the most important thing. So Christine wanted me to watch 500 Days of Summer. It stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Zooey Deschanel. And it's directed by Mark Webb. He's the one who did the Spider-Mans in between the Sam Raimi Spider-Mans and the Marvel Spider-Man. Have either of you, James or Daniel, seen 500 Days of Summer?
Nope. No. Sounds like some kind of punishment.
That's what I thought, too. Like, 500 Days of Summer. I thought this was going to be like a hipster movie, like Little Miss Sunshine. Yeah. And I went in with very low expectations, especially because Manic Pixie Dream Girl Zooey Deschanel is in it, right? And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, before he started getting respect in the mainstream, seemed more of a indie actor because no one could see him as anything but the kid from Third Rock from the Sun. So I went in for it with very low expectations of this movie. I didn't even know who the director was until I saw it in the opening credits. But this movie, to me, the best way I can describe it, just very quickly, is it's like a combination of Scott Pilgrim, Man Seeking Woman, with an inverted element of La La Land. And what I mean by that is it's more focused on the romance side than it is the romantic artistic side of the main character, the male main character. So basically what this movie is about is it's about the 500 days Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character knows Zooey Deschanel's character, Summer. And it Tarantino's the movie. It starts at day 500, and they're sitting on a park bench, and she puts her hand on his hand, and she has a wedding ring on her hand. So, of course, visually, you're going to assume, well, they're married. So you think this is going to be the 500 days that they fall in love. And that's what I thought just from the name of the movie. That's why I thought it was some indie, you know, piece of crap. But then it immediately cuts, and it goes to day one, and it goes, but this is not a love story. So the entire movie becomes about how you get to that moment and what that moment means with it not being a love story. Now, he does fall in love with her, and they have a whole relationship and everything. But I actually believe this movie is very important and relevant to a lot of what we talk about on the show as far as gender issues and as far as guys not being able to assert themselves. The basic flaw of Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character is that he's not able to assert himself and assert what he wants with Summer. There's one point where, so they work together. She's like the new secretary at his office, and they all go and do karaoke. And his friend, who he works with, who knows him very well, knows he likes her. And they're drunk, and they put him in a cab. And because he's drunk, he tells Summer, oh, he likes you. And then Summer looks at him and goes, is that true? And he's like, yeah, I like you. You're a cool person. I want to be your friend. And then she says, oh, because I'm interested in you. And she pauses, and then she says, as a friend. And, you know, they end up actually hooking up and having a relationship and everything. But they never go the extra mile where they're actually in a committed relationship and it's defined. And they never actually, she never actually falls in love with him. And it's really all about, and this is why I compare it to Scott Pilgrim, where Scott Pilgrim is ultimately not about the women in it. It's not about him achieving a relationship. It's about him getting the sort of self-respect and realizing that the most important thing in all of these relationships is respecting himself. And it's the same thing here. That's ultimately what the movie's about. It's not a love story. It's about him learning to love and respect himself and live in line with his values and assert himself in the world. And I think that's a really important story for guys to see nowadays. And it's a really important message about the lack of masculinity in our society. And one of the coolest scenes in the movie for me, and this is the comparison to Man Seeking Woman, is it embellishes certain things that happen to everyone to bring out the truth behind them. And one thing it does is it does split screen at one point. It has expectations versus reality. And it's when, at the end of the movie, near the end, Joseph Gordon-Levitt goes to a party at Summer's that she invites him to, and it's his expectations of what he thinks will happen and the reality of what he thinks and the reality of what does happen, and they're both happening at the same time. And that's a really cool way to execute that. So there's a lot of cool things in how this is written. There's a lot of cool things in how this is directed. Ultimately, my main critique is that it wasn't executed as well as it could have been. There, just even the final scene that you get to at the end of the 500 days where you find out why they were sitting on that park bench together and everything, just the way it was written to show that that was like his moment of catharsis and overcoming, I would have written it differently. I think it could have been written better. But still, it's one of the better movies I've seen in a long time. And if you like Scott Pilgrim, you like Man Seeking Woman, if you like sort of, if you like La La Land, but you want to see the inverse of it, watch this movie. It's really worth seeing. And if you care about these issues about the lack of masculinity in society, it's really inspiring to see that there are other people out there, and there are other artists in Hollywood who have made an impact in Hollywood who are seeing these things and making movies about these kind of ideas. So ultimately, I would give it a 7 out of 10.
2009. You want to guess the tomato meter?
I'm going to guess the tomato meter is at 63%.
Oh, interesting. No, 85%.
Interesting.
With an audience score of 84%. So pretty universal acclaim here for 500 Days of Summer.
I think if this movie came out today, it would be rated lower on the tomato meter. There was actually one point where they say a couple things that seem MRA.
Whoa.
Where they complain like,
whoa,
why is it controversial?
Yeah, just saying. Can't say anything that sounds even remotely like you think men are okay human beings.
Right, and that's what it is, where they're very critical of women at one point, and it's very much an MRA argument. Well, why are pretty women just allowed to treat men any way they want? And, you know, that's an important part of this movie, is Summer does not treat him well, but he never fully stands up for himself and protects himself and says, I don't deserve this treatment. And that's important to the movie, the way that she doesn't treat him well. And there is a lot of it is his fault, but at the same time, it's very intentionally that she's shown that way. So it's very interesting. I think it's worth watching. Did while you're looking at it, you have it up on IMDb, correct?
I did, and I just closed it. What do you want to know?
I wanted to know if Mark Webb also wrote it. I don't think he did, but.
Oh, I actually have Rotten Tomatoes open. Written by Scott Neustadler and Michael Weber.
Yeah, I don't know anything about either of them, so I'll probably look into them. I'll probably go and do some research and see what they're all about. Maybe they have some new stuff coming out. Don't know. But we know
Scott
who does
Neustadler,
have...
Sorry, Scott Neustadter. Neustadter is also is writing The Disaster Artist.
Okay, so there you go. He's in that whole general vicinity of James Franco, Judd Apatow is the word I'm looking for. Judd Apatow. So Judd Apatow has done a lot, I think, for masculinity in modern society. I mean, Superbad, right, is ultimately a comedy about masculine friendships.
Yeah.
So that's what he has coming out that's new. And we know other people that have stuff coming out that's new. Let's talk about those now.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Early Man is the latest claymation film by Nick Davis, the creator of Wallace and Gromit. It's about a tribe of cavemen. We see tribalism again. I think the main character is called Caveman, and they get into a soccer match, because this is an English movie. Nick Davis is an English animator, and the soccer match is against the leader of the Bronze Age, who wants to wipe out...
Football.
Yes, football. Who wants to wipe out the Stone Age, and if they win the game, if the cavemen win the game, they get to be left alone, and if they lose the game, they have to work in the mines. I'm going to go first here. Just because I have something really I really want to say about this, and then you guys can all go. This is another example, and I never like the idea that they're applying it to fucking cavemen is just fucking insane, of a movie demonizing technology and progress. Like, why is the bad guy the Bronze Age? Like, did people like invent bronze and they're like, okay, anyone still using stone, we're gonna fucking kill them. Like, that's just not how it works. This isn't, like, an interesting premise. It's just, like, who gives a shit? This is a, it's a stupid, 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 stupid premise. And for that reason, I'm tackling.
Tackle.
I'm right with you there. The premise of this seems poorly thought out, ill-conceived. Are there other words for being terrible? I'm sure there are a lot. The animation looks stunning, and the claymation and the Wallace and Gromit stuff has always been good, but this is next level for stop motion. It looks superb in terms of the quality of animation, but that is not going to be enough to get me to see this movie because I unequivocally cannot support the fact that cavemen want to stay primitive and thus die at like 30 years old and be terrible human beings. So, fuck you, movie. Tackle.
Tackle.
Yeah, this is really disappointing because I always liked the Wallace and Gromit guy. I really liked the animation. Yeah, same as Daniel. Really liked the animation. But something I'll add, though, the jokes weren't funny either.
Yeah,
it just wasn't funny. They did a lot of things attempting to be funny, and they just weren't. So tackle all around.
Tackle.
I don't think this will have redeeming qualities other than the animation. And if it's not even funny, it's like I won't even be able to enjoy it on that level. Tackle, tackle, tackle.
Second trailer.
The Man Who Invented Christmas is a biopic about Charles Dickens as he tries to save his career by coming up with A Christmas Carol. Again, I will go first this time because I have very strong things to say about this trailer as well. This is very reminiscent of me, reminiscent to me of the trailer about the guy who wrote Winnie the Pooh, the Dear Christopher Robin trailer, whatever the fuck that was. A.A. Milne, that is his name, correct. Thank you. I thought that, but I didn't want to say it and sound stupid. So thank you, Daniel. Are we really that at the bottom of the barrel that we're having writers write movies about other writers being awesome? Like, it just seems like it. Look, I'm a writer. I am an artist. There are ways to make movies about artists. La La Land is an example. But the struggle of the creative process is not an interesting conflict for a movie. It's not an interesting story to tell. And that is this concretized in one line in this trailer that I fucking laugh at and think is stupid. When he's like, if I don't come up with this story, I'll never write again. Really?
Yeah.
Really? Really? Look, I understand. I understand. As someone who, like, not a lot of my writing is read, you know, I've made the one web series. Like, it's difficult to find an audience. I get that. But basically what you're saying is, if the world will not recognize your brilliance, you're not going to continue to write? I mean, you can have a fucking job. You can go work in the goddamn factory and then write at home. I mean, fucking J.K. Rowling was a mother and had a job, and she fucking wrote the Harry Potter books on her free time, and now look at her.
Billionaire.
If you love writing, fucking write. I'm not saying you're going to become a billionaire. Oh. I'm not going to say you're going to get theme parks with your stuff out of it. But I'm just saying, if you love writing, you will continue to write. That fucking line is stupid. This movie is stupid. Stupid, stupid, stupid. Tackle.
Tackle.
Well, I'm kind of afraid to hug it now, but it looks fairly bad. I will say that this is what I appreciated about it, is we've seen, I don't know, 600 billion remakes of A Christmas Carol, and I thought that this was at least a valiant effort at coming up with a remake of A Christmas Carol that wasn't just a flat-out remake of A Christmas Carol.
Because in the studio, they sat there and they said, let's do A Christmas Carol, but do it meta.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, the kids on the internet will like that.
That's right. All these hipster kids will love it. So I would say that that's the one part about it that I want to emphasize is like, okay, well, thank you for thinking somewhat creatively about how to do this remake of a story we've heard 10,000 times. But overall, I think, you know, the thing about it is that the main actor didn't seem like a great actor. So I really didn't, like, I was kind of taken out of it because he seemed kind of terrible. So... I'm going to go ahead and tackle this one, though not as vehemently as Justin. I may, like, some years down the road watch this for free on, you know, Crackle or something.
Stupid.
This actually felt to me, I wanted to like this. It felt like there were certain elements I took from it immediately that I really liked. Just the idea of these characters coming to life. And I'm like, oh, I'd watch this during Christmas. Like, this sounds like a good way to get into the Christmassy spirit. But then it has this drama that it just felt really contrived. Just, I didn't necessarily notice the moral aspect of not writing again if this particular story isn't published and it doesn't get reads. I didn't notice that so much as just noticing, like, why are we introducing this really weird drama into a story about, like, wonder and creativity and coming up with Scrooge and Tiny Tim and all these characters in your mind and they're very real to you? Like, that sounds fun. Why do we need, like, the drama just seemed completely out of place there.
Because it's not an interesting conflict. The creative process is
right.
Not. Look, if the creative process was an interesting conflict, all the fucking Blu-ray special feature commentary tracks would be released in theaters and people would go see them. People would have liked Lady in the Water if people liked the creative process as a struggle. That's what the whole fucking movie's about.
Yeah.
And I like Lady in the Water. So are you tackling, James?
Yeah, but I mean, I'll watch it, like, if my family wants to watch it. I think I'll end up liking it, but it just doesn't look like a good movie, if that distinction makes sense. And that's saying something, because there's no firearms in the whole movie, as far as I could tell.
Third trailer.
Lady Bird. I don't even fucking
tackle.
Know what
this is. Tackle.
All right, moving on. Yeah, I tackle as well.
It's about teen angst or some shit? Like,
I don't know.
Is what I want to say about this trailer, right? Like, it endeared itself to me in, like, the first, like, 30 seconds. Because she was like, I'm sick of California. I want to go to the East Coast where culture is. I was like, that argument is not made enough. Thank you, trailer. Why are you arguing with Sheldon's mom? And then everything went downhill from here.
Yeah. Mediocre teenage girl thinks she's better than she is and complains to everyone about it is not a compelling premise for a movie, book, short story, or a compelling premise for a blowjob. Like, nothing could get me interested in that story. Nothing.
You just, like, killed the dreams of many teenage high school boys with that.
Tackle.
Obviously, I'm tackling as well. James, you want to give your reason for tackling?
I could only watch, I think, half of the trailer, which means I would not be able to get through the movie, even if I was really trying. So, yeah, tackle. I hated this on every level. Just, I hated the person. Let's move on.
I have one other weird observation about this trailer, which is that there were so many cuts in this trailer to so many radically different scenes that either this movie is disjointed as fuck or it's going to be 7 hours long. There are many scenes.
I feel like a lot of trailers do that.
Trailer.
I feel like a...
It's probably a long naturalistic piece, which is very difficult to cut a trailer for. So they have to just pull random small bits from everywhere.
Yeah, I mean...
Look, here's a question. Yeah, okay.
Go ahead.
Was the first Atlas Shrugged movie kind of naturalistic? Because that's how the trailer for the first Atlas Shrugged movie felt. It was just like you have Ellis Wyatt where he's just, maybe you should let me finish speaking. And they try to make it sound all dramatic. Like that particular line really stood out to me in both the trailer and in the movie for completely different reasons, because they both just seemed really out of place. Like, because it's this outpouring of emotion on the actor's part who's really trying, and then none of the context is set up, so it just seems kind of funny in both the trailer and in the movie itself.
The key word you said there about is the lack of context being set up. The first Atlas Shrugged comes across as naturalistic because it's just a series of vignettes. There's no story and there's no conflict. It's just like, here's a scene. And like, if you've read the book, you're like, oh, I see they're making scenes from the book and they're stringing them together temporally.
Yeah. Yep. Incidentally, the actor who played Ellis Wyatt, he was at the premiere when I saw it. And, like, I wanted to say something positive about it, so I went up to him. He was the actor himself was there, and I went up to him and said, like, oh, I thought you did really well. And it was so sad because he was like, no, I really didn't. And I could smell, like, whiskey on his breath, and I'm like, shit. It was so sad.
Oh, that's hilarious. I took a date to the premiere in D.C.
Oh, God.
Yeah. We didn't speak again after that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, All right. Next trailer.
Final trailer.
Friend Request is a horror movie, and I don't really understand it. It's like if you friend someone on Facebook, and then they get infected by the meme that turns you suicidal, you get infected by the meme that turns you suicidal, and slowly everyone becomes suicidal. Is this a meme commentary? I don't know.
It's a social media commentary, right? Like, we all may have all these friends online, but we're all just really alone.
Is that what they're going for?
I assume.
I didn't get that.
I assume that's what they're going for. I don't... Yeah. No. Any
this
horror
felt
that tries to be
me...
relevant, I don't care about anymore.
Right. This felt to me like a perfectly legitimate horror plot, but with this social media stuff just imposed onto it to make it topical, and then that's when it just lost me.
Also,
but then again, Justin's interpretation makes it sound like a much better movie than what I interpreted it to be.
Well, to be fair, my interpretation may have been me rewriting the movie in my head.
I know, right, yeah, but I don't know, now that you say it, like, that does connect a lot of dots for me in the preview, so you may be right, and if you are, like, that sounds okay. I'm not a horror guy, but, like, that sounds fine as a premise that, like, you're, you know, it's transferred via social media, like, that's fine. I just don't want social media imposed onto... like a horror plot just so we can be topical. And this is not the first time this has happened. There was some other trailer, I think we even reviewed it, like, where it was a horror social media base. Unfriended, yeah. And this is the same fuck. You could have named this fucking movie Unfriended, because the conflict starts when a someone who had low self esteem gets unfriended, like. Fuck off.
Right, but it seemed to imply that she developed the low self-esteem from unfriending someone else.
Oh, they imply that?
It seemed to.
Okay, I don't know. I'm not a horror guy, so I'm not going to watch. I'm just not going to watch this. But the trailer seemed to not give it a fair shake.
Just tackle it, dude.
Okay, tackle. Wait, Jesus, tackle. Justin, you always pressure me into tackling it when I want to give a nuanced opinion.
I have one other thing about horror movies in general, which is, I miss the days when we could have a horror movie that had no supernatural element to it at all. Like, why does everything have to be some weird meme monster that comes out of your computer, or a creepy little girl who was cursed 10,000 years ago, or can't we just make Scream, like something like Scream, or something like Psycho, for instance? Why does everything have to have a supernatural element to it?
Watch Bates Motel, the series from A&E.
Does it have a supernatural element to it?
No.
No.
From an artistic standpoint, can't horror be made much more compelling by the supernatural? Because the whole idea of horror is that you should be afraid. And what makes you more afraid than the supernatural? Because the supernatural is necessarily that which cannot be understood. If it's just at the end of a day, an asshole in a mask with a knife, that's not as scary as something from another dimension that is going to kill you and you have no idea why. So seems like just necessary to the horror genre.
There's a gestalt there, James. And the gestalt is, when I immediately see supernatural, I'm automatically not afraid. Because I know it's non-existent.
Right.
Whereas,
well, not everyone feels that way.
When I watch Psycho, I think, oh, there are crazy fucks in the world. I don't see them as, you know, being abundant or like I'm in real danger, but that's what actually causes me fear in that situation. And when it's Casper the unfriendly fucking ghost, I don't give a shit anymore.
Yeah. I have a similar emotional reaction to Daniel. It's not that I just know it doesn't exist, therefore I'm not afraid. I'm not that I'm advocating the existence of the supernatural. I'm just saying my emotional reaction to the supernatural in movies is different. My reaction is just, oh, this is just it in this, the metaphysics of this universe, it simply is evil. So there's nothing to be afraid of. It's just, that's a fact of reality. It's sort of like if I touch a hot stove, it burns me. So I don't attribute agency to it or anything. It's just sort of like that exists. It's a fact of reality. Like, so it's not scary to me. It's just, that's the way it is. Like, if you do this thing on this social media network, you'll die. So just don't fucking do it on the social media network. That's not scary to me. But it's scary to me when a human being has agency and they do fucked up shit. Like, one of the scariest scenes I've ever seen is 28 weeks later, where the people are trying to get free from the containment because they want to be free and the government's keeping them to try and contain the outbreak of the zombies. And they break the containment and they start running away, and the military just starts shooting into the crowd. That's terrifying to me, because there are human beings just slaughtering other human beings, and you can understand on a level why they're doing it, but it's also incredibly fucked up that they're doing it. That's much scarier to me than a supernatural thing.
So I think, James, maybe it's a little gestalt-y. Like, I think you could just see it from either perspective, so...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and for me, what I think you've kind of identified why horror movies are generally not that interesting to me is because I'm just not afraid of ghosts, is what it comes down to. But like,
you're a ghost,
a lot of times, I ain't afraid of no ghosts. But a lot of times in these horror movies, there's like a small vignette that's psychological. Like, a lot of times there's a hint in a horror movie that the real like root of the terror is in the psychology of the characters. That gets me. That at least sparks interest in me. I don't know if I like it, but it's compelling.
Yeah. It used to be that horror movies were a comment on morality, and it was the idea that the people who died brought about their own deaths by being immoral. That's sort of been lost.
Right. Well, I mean, recently I saw a movie that was kind of like that. I think it was called The Strangers. It's just these people in, like, bunny masks stabbing the protagonists. And it's implied that, like, these strangers showed up because they couldn't – because they were afraid to, like, move on with their lives. And so they were forced to – they were forced to confront, like, their values and how they should have married one another. And then it's too late because they get stabbed to death.
Yeah, and I saw that movie in theaters. I didn't think it was very good, but I saw it because to me the trailer was frightening. The idea that these guys in masks decided to show up and like fucking torture these people. That's terrifying to me.
Yeah.
All right, you want to know what else is scary to us? The internet. It's time for Reddit on Reddit.
These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma boring felines.
First Reddit, what's the biggest waste of money that we're expected to take part in?
Oh,
and I'm just
going
to say the obvious answer, taxes.
Hashtag taxation is theft.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no other
answer.
That's
a good obvious one. No, there's a lot of fucking answers. It just so happens that's the best one.
Well, there are, but I'm just saying mathematically there are no other answers.
Right,
yeah,
and
that's
just
true.
To explain a little bit for maybe new listeners to the Midside, because we don't want to just preach to the choir the whole time. The issue is that when we're talking about waste of money, the amount of money that the government gets and then wastes is just fucking through the roof, right? I mean, we can sit here and debate taxation is theft, but let's just sit here for a second and talk about the waste of the money we give them. So not only are they taking a shitload of their money, of our money, they're not fucking doing anything with it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's worse than that, though, Justin, because not only are they often not doing anything with it, but often they're positively damaging your life with that money, because that money goes to regulatory agencies to make sure that people who are in business can't find creative solutions to problems. So it's like... A lot of times I say, like, when I get taxed $1, I would spend $2 to make sure the government doesn't get that $1.
Yeah,
like,
that's
the sort of – because they do, like, not only do they take a dollar from me, but they do $2 worth of damage to my life or more with that money.
I agree completely. I was just looking at the purely pragmatic, practical level of wasting it.
The flip side of that, by the way, you know – obviously, the government expense is the biggest one, but, like, think about the amount of resources consumed just dealing with the tax system. Like, record-keeping, accountants, making sure that you file back taxes, amendments, making sure you're tracking employee taxing payroll, your deductions. Like, it is a billion-dollar industry just to deal with how much we have to deal with the taxes. Like, it's an incredible, incredible waste of money. Incredible. Anything else?
Can I give
a billion...
small piddly things, but, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, can I give another answer? It's actually said in the Reddit thread, and I just wanted to say it. The bar scene they talk about, where it's just...
Oh, my God,
people go
that was mine.
And spend a lot of money on alcohol. As someone who is straight edge and doesn't do that... I honestly don't know how all you fucking people survive. Like, how did you make it through your 20s? No, I really don't. Like, with the amount of money I saw people spend at the bar, or they go out and they spend $14 on an IPA in downtown LA, how do you fucking live? How do you afford to put gas in your car? How do you buy new clothes? How do you buy food?
I don't.
When I get to the point where that's in my budget, that's like, that kills my budget for the month when I have to buy new clothes. Like, it's like, okay, that was my discretionary income for the month.
Silly Justin, you're budgeting.
Oh, my dog. Yeah, the bars are almost as egregious as taxation, because, oh, my God. The biggest thing for me with bars, as a drinker myself, I don't know if all of you on the Midside knew this, but I sometimes drink.
James is an alcoholic, just like all of you other fucks who drink.
All of you other insignificant.
I just, you know, here's how I feel about most bars is like, okay, not only do you get to be in a place that's loud, preventing you from socializing, but at least you also get to spend four times more money on your alcohol. Like, I just strongly prefer having a beer at home with my friends at home where there's no noise or maybe a little ambiance music so we can just talk.
Yeah.
With the exception of microbreweries, which I really love because you can taste all the beers. And those and microbreweries aren't expensive, and they're not trashy people there. It's $4.50 for a pint, which is still a lot, but it's like, but it's really fucking good beer. It's worth it. It's like going to, you know, I don't know. It's an experience. It's a gourmet experience, and you don't end up spending that much money if you treat it that way because you don't end up going that often. But bars in general, Jesus,
yeah.
Guys, stop were, going to bars. Defund the bars.
Like fucking terrible beer or well drinks, there is no reason for you to be out. None. You are just literally
yeah.
taking money, putting it in a blender, and drinking it. Like, there's no fucking point. Now, there is a tipping point, I will say, on the other end, which is I do like to go to cocktail bars because they have things that I'm not going to make at home. There's just no way I'm going to have that assortment of ingredients. But Jesus Christ, we're getting to a point, like, D.C., we went to this trendy cocktail bar the other day because someone said it is fantastic. The fucking cheapest cocktail on the menu was $18.
Ah!
Nothing in that cocktail is worth that amount of money. Nothing.
That's like two pop figures at least.
Yeah, and it, like, they were up to, like, 36. They were up to $36. Okay, wait a minute, I just got the joke that you're buying. Okay, so anyway, yeah, nothing in the cocktail is worth that amount of money unless you're literally putting a pop in the cocktail. That'd be interesting.
It's almost a tank of gas. Like, you could drive somewhere and go somewhere, but besides the fucking bar, but you, rather than putting the liquid that fuels your car in your car, you're putting the liquid that destroys your body in your body.
Yeah. Take a big sniff there. Self-satisfied sniff. I will say that we are not far away, certainly in D.C., from basically the $20 cocktail being the average cocktail cost. D.C. is just expensive.
So what you're saying is in D.C. a cocktail costs more than a cock.
Yes. Oh, certainly. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, not that I would know, but definitely. 100%. I mean, I don't know, but clearly.
Next Reddit, and this is a serious Reddit. What happened to sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me? They're, of course, referring to, with this question, the saying that when I was a kid, that was very, very prevalent. Like, if anyone said mean shit to me when I was a kid, that was what I was told to brush it off.
Well, now we have the saying, words are violence, and thus I can punch you in the face, you Nazi. But other than that, so... The question, do they mean, like, why don't children say this anymore? Or do they mean, like, what happened to it as we grew up? How do you want to interpret it?
Just it being a cultural trope, I think, is how that what they're saying. Like, just something we refer to as, like, a piece of pop philosophy to remind ourselves, like, oh, yeah, that's not something... That's how we deal with that abstraction.
Because...
The wonderful thing about Reddit on Reddit is you can interpret it any way you wish.
Excellent. So the wonderful, the horrifying thing about this thread was reading all the replies. And the replies were basically an excuse for why we should think words are worse than violence. The thread here is basically, to give you the overview, is like, we grew up and realized that psychology matters, we grew up and realized that words have power, we grew up and realized... that actions aren't the worst thing you could do. We grew up and realized that that our feelings are important. Like, it's just a bunch of excuses for why we can be a bunch of namby-pamby idiots now.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
If you want to know what's wrong with Reddit, it's that thread encapsulated. I mean, that is leftist social justice nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it is worth noting that there's a shred of truth to what they're saying that the saying doesn't capture. Like, if someone really... Well, here's what I mean. Like, I mean it in a very delimited sense. Like, if someone really is hurt by someone else's words, you can't just repeat these statements. You can't just repeat this sort of idiom to them and help their actual problem. Their problem is that they're on a, like, sort of a epistemological level treating... other people's words as an actual reflection on their own slash basing their self-esteem on other people's opinions of them. And this phrase does not help them out of that. Now, the sorts of social justice bullshit that comes along with the rejection of this phrase is the worst possible thing for them to get over it. But I think in general, we need to recognize these mental issues, but also not pander to them. And at the end of the day, it's completely true. Words need not hurt you.
Do I need to deconstruct the writing of this phrase? Okay, so there are two clauses in this phrase. The first clause.
No, it's a completely correct phrase. It's a completely. I would. But it's just.
No,
that
you're missing
it doesn't
something.
Help
Shut up.
Someone who.
Shut up! Stop talking! You fucking moron! You're missing something. Okay?
Okay.
Listen to what I'm saying. You can respond to me and tell me I'm a moron afterwards. That's fine, but you're wrong.
Okay.
And I'm going to explain why you're wrong. All right?
Okay.
I love the first new phrase. Adam, Dr. Drew mentality that we have going on here.
Thank you for picking up that reference. If, James, if you listen to the Adam and Dr. Drew podcast, that's what I was referencing by doing that. So don't take it
personally. I actually haven't, so it was a little weird just telling me I'm a fucking moron. But go on. I'm rolling with it. Words
yeah,
can't hurt
it,
me after
understand.
All.
Right. No, exactly. So look, the first clause here is sticks and stones may break my bones. So it's setting up the idea that we're talking about physical pain. And we're talking about the physical pain that you have to deal with and then rehab from. And so then the second one says, but words will never hurt me. So the point is, you are not going to be physically hurt by the words that affected you. And what that's saying is, you can deal with it and you can figure out that the words aren't to be taken that seriously because concretely, it's not going to hurt you in the long run because the focus is on the physical. Now, I'm not saying that you can't be hurt psychologically. I'm not saying that at all. I understand that you can be hurt psychologically. But you have phrases like this, and when you go through therapy, because I have and I've learned things from it, you learn things like this to reinforce proper thinking. And this is something that reinforces proper thinking because what it's saying is when you repeat it, if I feel hurt by these words, I shouldn't let myself feel hurt by these words, and I need to understand why I am so I will not continue to feel hurt by these words in the future. That's the purpose of saying this phrase. It's not saying to just ignore it. It's saying that you're not dealing with it properly by letting it get to you because you shouldn't let it get to you. It's acknowledging the reality of that it's unhealthy to react in the way the social justice victim culture reacts because it hurts your self-esteem. It hurts, as I've said earlier in the show, your efficacy because it's giving it externally. It's saying it's a second-handed way. This phrase is anti-second-handedness. The end.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I'm saying that for some people, it doesn't. It does. It's not a. It's not the whole story for some people. Is all I would say.
Well, then
that's
get
not
fucking
a criticism
therapy.
Of it. Yeah, right. I mean
that's
it's not
like
a criticism
saying, like,
of
here,
it.
Take
but like,
take this medicine. It's going to cure you of this disease. Well, it's not going to cure everyone of that disease. Then go to the fucking doctor.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, I'm not criticizing the phrase. I'm just trying to extract. I'm always on the lookout to extract the good part, even of bad people's logic, because even crazy points of view like SJWism, I think they can alert you to certain facts. I mean, they have it completely fucking wrong, but like they can alert you to certain facts that the other side a lot of times can't. And that's not to say that they're right about anything, because they take these new facts completely out of context and use it to their own despicable ends, but you got to acknowledge the argument, and that's kind of what I'm doing. I always look for the best part of what everyone says, not in order to find the best in everyone, but so I can learn from everyone.
But what this is what social justice is. This goes back to the banana peel story, is it's just a signal. It's just a flag that there's a lot of fucking trauma going on, and that trauma must be treated. That's what we can learn from social justicism. The problem is, to go back to the banana peel story, they're indulging to the trauma that they're stopping people from getting their dicks sucked. And that's the problem. is you could be out there fucking people, but they're telling you, no, we can't because we're dealing with trauma, so we can't participate in life celebratory activities like having sex. That's the problem.
You can either have BJs or social justice, but you can't have both.
That's right. You can either have BJs or SJs. Pick one.
Oh, there you go.
Last Reddit. What does your pet do that diversifies itself from other pets? And I love this phrasing because it's like, do you want to go into the evolutionary explanation of why cats are different from dogs? Like,
it's so silly. As a new pet owner, I would say that my pet has lots of things that typify pethood. There are things that I've seen it do that I've never seen other of my pets do, but I don't think that's rare. So for instance, like if you give my dog a treat that looks like a bone in any way, including like flat treats that look like bones, but then aren't like actually anamorphic bones, he will try to bury them in the carpet. He will find a corner. He'll put it in the corner and then he will use his nose on the carpet as if the carpet is dirt. And he will try to shovel the carpet onto the bone and will get wildly pissed off when it doesn't disappear. Now, on the other side of this, he's a smart little fucking beast. And if you remove that bone from the corner, in his mind, that means, oh, yep, I did bury it. And so then he tries to fucking dig it up.
Oh my god, that is some evolutionary wiring gone haywire there.
Yes. Yes, he doesn't know what to do. He also rapes his bed regularly, so.
I expected that to go.
I use that phraseology because he goes at his bed, but he, like, bites it, like, as if he was biting the neck of the bed to hold it down. So.
That's pretty hot.
Xerxes and his doggy rape fantasies.
That's right. That's right. He only his bed requires concubine. That you kneel. Yes. Justin, how about your weirdo pets?
Well, I think we've all experienced my cats here on the podcast.
The
podcasts. They love talking to me as if they are human beings. And it's just they don't shut up. And just bizarre things they do, like... One cat, when she wants me to clean their litter box, she will use it. So that's when I know she wants me to clean it. Like, I'll come home and then she'll, like, immediately jump in the litter box. Like, oh, he's home. I have to tell him to clean the litter box. It's just weird shit like that. It's just weird.
It's
or, funny. Like, they wait till I go to sleep to start yelling.
Yeah. Interesting.
My cats act like dogs. I don't know if anyone's noticed
James,
that.
So, James, what does your girlfriend do?
Oh.
She's very diverse. She's diversified herself from all other animals. Well, I don't have a pet right now other than Mackenzie. I just remember my dog Molly. She died like 2 years ago. But something she would do is she would open the door with her paw. Like, she would just open the door with her paw just as a matter of course. She got so good at it, she could just run up to the door and then just sort of stick her front paw out and just, like, bash the door aside, just run in. Like, it wasn't even hard. A lot of dogs can open doors, but she got so good at it, wasn't even, like, an impediment to her. And then she would just get... She would, like, put this tennis... She would... She'd want you to throw the tennis ball, but, like... Once she'd grab it, she didn't fully understand the concept of fetch. So, like, I'd throw the tennis ball, she'd grab it, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to throw it again. But, like, she wouldn't let go of the fucking ball. Like, I'd grab it and try to yank it out of her mouth, and she'd just go, like, to try to keep, I guess it was fetch and tug of war, I think, maybe. Maybe I didn't get it, now that I'm thinking about it.
James, she was just telling you that fetch is never going to happen.
Yeah, stop trying to make
what
it happen.
What does that mean? What is that a reference to something?
That is a reference to something, and we are going to end this episode. What did we learn this trip, Daniel?
James has never seen Mean Girls.
I haven't.
That's sad. Is that your final answer, Daniel?
Yes.
Right. James?
I've gathered some data points about social justicism today that I don't know how to put together, but I've mentioned them, kind of this cluster of things about why is it that they're against men? Like, how does that integrate into everything else? And then what does tribalism mean to them? And then what was the other one? And what's up with their fixation on mental illness? Or not fixation with it, but it seems like they have a lot of references towards mental illness and the treatment thereof, and that's in a lot of their lingo, it would appear. And then also just integrating that in with the fact that they have the wrong cure, which is the appeasement of these mental illnesses instead of the treatment of them. And so what I learned is just that these are some data points I think that can be integrated, and I don't have them fully integrated yet.
All right. Justin, what did you learn?
I finally learned how to insult all 7 billion people on the planet at the same time.
Insignificant fucks. Well, everyone on the planet may be insignificant, but you know who's not insignificant, Justin? Midsiders.
Not to us. Well, you can be significant to people who are important to you, and you are important to us.
Midsiders stand above all others in their commitment to truth, justice, and even the American way. That's right, I said it. So thank you very much, Midsiders, for tuning in. If you want to interact with us on the social medias, we're all over, everywhere. Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, and probably some other things that I haven't even heard of yet, at The Midside. Everywhere at The Midside. You can talk to Justin. You can submit Wooker joke stories. You can tell us that we're fucking idiots. You can praise us. You can send us trailers. We like those. You can send us, dick pics, but mostly to Justin. So no one else cares. And, you can go to themidside.com/podcast where you can listen to all the past episodes of the podcast, including the Snyder series and the recently released first episode of The Nolan Notes. Yeah, so that was fun to do. We're going to do more of those in the future. What else can they do at the website? Oh, they can go to themidside.com/store and get a t-shirt. You can get a False Dichotomy Bro t-shirt, or you can get the Hail Snydra shirt, or just the Midside logo. You can wear it proud. That's right. What else can you do, Justin, on themidside.com? That's about it, right? Read our bios.
Themidside.com/Patreon.
Oh, themidside.com/Patreon. Thank you. Patreon is a platform that allows you, the Midsiders, to help us defray some of the costs of this show. You can choose to subscribe to give us money every time we produce a piece of content. That's right. It's not a subscription that's monthly or weekly or whatever. It's a subscription for when we produce content. If we take time off, no money taken away. It can be as little as 10 cents, it can be $5, it can be $100, whatever you think our words are worth. And Justin's words, I think, are pretty fucking valuable, so clearly.
Thank you, that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
Yeah, I was lying, so. No, I'm just kidding. No, of course Justin's words are valuable. He's a smart guy, does all this review stuff and analytics, and where else are you getting that? Everybody, other than
where
Justin
else?
Here at the Midside. So you can do that. You can subscribe on iTunes or Google Play, where you can also leave us a 5-star review. Even if this is the worst podcast you've ever heard, type that in and then click the little 5-star button. Thank you very much. Liberty.me, libertarian folks, helping us be syndicated since season 4 or something like that. It's been forever now that we've been syndicated on this libertarian network, and we appreciate it because we like the libertarians coming here. We may disagree with you on a few things. But that's okay. We're big tent here. Big tent Midsiders. That's what we are.
I pretty much call myself a libertarian anyway, so
yeah, whatever. And then, of course...
And I have a big tent every time I'm doing the podcast, so...
Oh. Yeah, Snapchat that. And then, of course, the most important thing you can do, and I mean this in its sincerity, is mail us cash. No, the most important thing you can do... is tell a friend about the show. When you tell a friend, that creates one more of your friends who has been told that we exist, and that is a beautiful thing.
Wow.
Because that's how we grow this show. That's how we grow the Midside Network, is through you, the Midsiders, letting other human beings know that they should be Midsiders too.
Yeah, and there some Midsiders have done that, and then their friends really love the show. So if you love it and you're healthy and rational, you're going to have friends who will also love it.
That's right. That's right.
Or even your unhealthy and irrational friends. Show them the Midside so that they can know health and rationality.
So I was saying if the Midsider is rational and healthy, they will have friends who are similar to them.
Nope, just kidding.
Right. I was also saying that if you have irrational and unhealthy friends, you can also tell them. Don't make it exclusive.
Are you really shitting on my point now, Dr. Drew?
He's not shitting.
Yes.
He's yes-anding because you want to tell your irrational friends so they at least get an hour and a half of therapy every week. That's really the reason to tell them.
That's right.
So, yeah, tell your friends. And until next time. Hold on. Belichick Your Premises. New sports podcast coming out soon. Our first episode is out, but we're going to record a new one this week. And be sure
every
to check
Tuesday.
That out. Every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday.
And when are we doing the next episode of the Nolan Notes?
Oh, man.
I don't know, whenever I fucking feel like it. God damn it.
Oh, okay. Woman? It says next episode in the outline,
yeah.
So I thought I'd bring
that
up, too.
I fucked up the outline. Use your brain.
Oh, he did use his brain. He read the outline. How about you fucking edit things and read? Forget it. Justin's words are worthless. Don't pay him for anything.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Evlazeski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day!